You know, anybody can write a 3-hour speech, but you shouldn't. You know, you should try to edit. You know, someone will say, hey, I want to give a 45-minute speech. I'll say, why don't you try to make it 20? There's an apocryphal saying that's attributed to President Kennedy. I don't know if it's true or not, but he always said, you know, keep my speeches shorter than 12 minutes, because after that, everybody's either thinking about food or sex.
Inspiring leaders and professionals to become better at their work. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Denk Tank, the official podcast brought to you by Denk Productions. My name is Remy Ludo Giering, editor-in-chief of the business publications MT and Sprouts. Next to me is my co-host and founder of Denk Productions, Hans Jansen. And our honored guest is former director of speech writing of Barack Obama and co-writer for his latest memoirs, Cody Keenan. Cody, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hans, first of all, you have had some impressive speakers on stage during your seminars, but the former director of speech writing of Barack Obama is very impressive. How did you lure Cody to travel all the way to the Netherlands once or twice a year to share his insights?
Yes, well, I think it all started with Cody's predecessor, John Favreau, who was a speaker at some of our seminars on influencing and speech writing and speeching. And John decided to do a podcast, which totally got out of hand in a positive way. And he said, you know,
Pod Save America.
Pod Save America.
Yeah.
And he advised me, he said, you know, if you want to have, I think John is named the Mozart of speech writing. He said, if you want a Bruce Springsteen of speech writing instead, you need to have Cody Keenan. So I thought, okay, let's get this. And it's really nice. And I think, Cody, you're still doing some work for President Obama, aren't you?
I still work for him full time.
What is it like to work with one of the best, maybe the best president the United States ever had?
Oh, he'd love to hear you say that. It's a wonderful struggle. It's wonderful because you get the chance while you're in the office to not just shape policy, but, you know, really, really create a story about, you know, especially as a speechwriter, who we are, you know, where we've been and where we're going. The struggle part is, you know, trying to live up to his expectations, because he's a talented writer in his own right. He wrote two books before any of us came along. And, you know, I'd kill myself to try to get the draft to a perfect place before getting it to him. And then back to the wonderful part, you know, he'll usually work on it and take it somewhere even higher.
And does it hurt when you work very hard on the speech and then it comes back with all these notes on it?
It did at first, maybe the first couple of years. And then you realize that's actually a good thing. You know, the bad news is if it comes back with no edits other than see me. And then he wants the entire thing started over. But edits actually mean that you got it to a place where he can work on it, where he can just gradually make it better. And that's what it took me a while to learn. It took probably 2 years. And I've been working for him now for almost 13 years. But the relationship between a speechwriter and the principal, the person who's giving the speeches, should be collaborative. That's what makes it good. And, you know, the best possible collaboration is when you hand drafts back and forth and each one gets better than the last.
How big of a speech is in the writing, and how much is presentation?
You know, I think it's probably 90% writing, 10% presentation. Yeah, I think so. And you should practice. You should be prepared. And, you know, you should pay for it. I mean, President Obama didn't come out fully formed when he first started his political career. He paid for lessons and coaching and support and training. But, you know, a good speech is, the whole point of it is to make a thoughtful, logical argument. And that takes time. I mean, you know, the speech would say the State of the Union address, for example, which is the worst speech to have to write. But that would take about 2 weeks to put together and then 1 hour to deliver. And he'd probably practice it once. You know, we do a full run through that afternoon. But, you know, presentation matters for sure, because people are going to see this. But, you know, a speech is meant to be heard. It's written for the ear and not the eyes. So you have to put a lot of care into how you put words and sentences and paragraphs together so that your audience can follow along.
Is it more difficult to write a long speech, well, somewhat long, like the State of Union, which takes an hour? Or is it more difficult to write a very powerful speech which has to be delivered in like 5 minutes?
Shorter. Shorter is much harder. You know, anybody can write a 3-hour speech, but you shouldn't. You know, you should try to edit. I'll often tell, you know, someone will say, hey, I want to give a 45-minute speech. I'll say, why don't you try to make it 20? You know, if you can't say what you want to say in 20 minutes, then you shouldn't be up there. Now, that said, President Obama often wanted to say a lot, so we did give hour-long speeches from time to time. I tried my best to walk him back from that, but he said, no, I have all these points I want to make. But shorter is always harder. Editing is tough. You know, you think you can't get something out. Sleep on it. Look at it the next day. Cut another paragraph or two. You can do it.
Do people still like pay attention after 20 minutes?
So that's the thing. That's why you want to keep it short. If you start seeing people looking at their phones or looking around or drifting off, your speech is too long. There's an apocryphal saying that's attributed to President Kennedy. I don't know if it's true or not, but he always said, you know, keep my speeches shorter than 12 minutes, because after that, everybody's either thinking about food or sex.
We'll make this podcast 22 minutes, and then yes. We can see how the last two minutes will go.
Do you have because you've been working together for 13 years now. Now, did you develop a certain working pattern on delivering speech? Do you have a certain way you do it each time?
Absolutely. It's different depending on the speech. You know, a State of the Union address, I would start maybe a month in advance, gathering thoughts and ideas from across the government. That's an outlier. You know, typically, if you wanted to give a speech of any substance, we would sit down 5 days before and for what we call the download, and we'd ask him questions, and he would just kind of talk, and I'd type it out and then run back to my desk and start putting it together. I typically wouldn't give him a draft until the night before. And he'd stay up working on it until 2-3 in the morning. He was a night owl. And then I'd pick up edits from him around 7:30 in the morning, put them in, and then we're off and running. And that's what made him so easy, is that he had enough trust in us to know what he wanted to say, that he didn't want drafts until the day before. But I've also worked with clients who wanted a draft, you know, 2-3 weeks, a month before. And that's much tougher, because then you're going through a ton of drafts, which is fine. But he just made it easy by only having to do it once.
You once said in an interview that Barack Obama often reminded you that he's a better speechwriter than you are.
All the time. All the time.
Not a humble man, is he?
He's always said he's a better speechwriter than his speechwriters. He will, you know, that the 2004 speech that, you know, made him, turned him from a nobody into a political rock star. He wrote that himself back in 2004, and he will remind us of that all the time.
How many speeches did you write with him, for him? I think I heard some kind of an exact number a few years ago, but I don't know if you still...
Yeah. Well, the exact number of speeches and statements he gave in the White House was 3,570. I don't know how many of those I wrote or edited, but my best guess is around 2,000.
And of all these babies, which one is your favorite?
Oh, man, that's hard. No, it's actually easy. My favorite was the last speech he ever gave in the White House, which was welcoming the world champion Chicago Cubs, my favorite baseball team, to celebrate. That's a personal favorite. But, you know, the ones we always enjoyed were the ones where you could speak to something bigger about humanity or America or the world. The speech he gave in Selma is a personal favorite, where he spent a lot of time talking about the American character and the idea of American exceptionalism, that what actually makes America great is not that we're great by virtue, but that we can change, and that, you know, generations worth of activists and marchers and organizers have, you know, pushed to make sure that we actually live up to the ideals we say we do. And sometimes you take a step back, or two or three, like we are right now, but then other times, you know, good wins, and people work and take care of each other and move the country forward.
We might be able to listen to an outtake from the Selma speech. Let's try and listen.
The March on Selma was part of a broader campaign that spanned generations. The leaders that day, part of a long line of heroes. We gather here to celebrate them. We gather here to honor the courage of ordinary Americans willing to endure billy clubs and the chastening rod, tear gas and the trampling hoof, men and women who, despite the gush of blood and splintered bone, would stay true to their North Star and keep marching towards justice. They did as Scripture instructed: rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer.
How important are the first lines of a speech like that?
They're important because you want to grab the audience immediately. You want to grab their attention. So I would always work really hard to have, you know, one or two really great lines right at the beginning. The challenge is in politics, there's always this tendency for people to thank the audience for coming and thank dignitaries. And I've always found that so boring, you know, just to give up. That's precious real estate at the top of a speech. And to give that up for saying, thank you so-and-so for coming. Thank you for having me. Thank you so-and-so for coming. It's fine, but it gets a little bit dull. I'd much rather grab somebody at the throat right in the beginning and make them pay attention.
I saw yourself giving a speech at a university somewhere on the internet, of course. Do you find it hard to give a speech yourself?
Yes, it's very tough. Yeah, I've gotten better at the actual delivery of it. You know, it's like anything else. I don't get nervous anymore. But writing for myself was a real challenge. You know, after writing so many speeches for him, to try to find my own voice and think about what I care about and believe in, that's tougher than you think. And there were a lot of things I wrote in that speech where I said, you know what, this sounds too much like him. I got to put this in my own voice.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine that people will also compare that with the style of President Obama.
Were there things in his style that you tend to dislike, which you tried to change, but he was just too stubborn?
I got to be careful, man. What if he's listening to this podcast?
What if he's listening? Yeah, wow.
Yeah, for sure. He did have a tendency. He does have a tendency to, you know, want to over-explain things and say everything, and you don't always have to. People have criticized that as professorial. I mean, it's one of the burdens of being as smart as he is. But otherwise, no, I never worried when he ad-libbed, because it was almost always something great. But his tendency is to go on, and he'll throat clear by saying things like, let me be clear. And one of his personal favorites is, you know, straw men. He'll say something unsavory and then say, I reject that notion. So for his birthday one year, I gave him a poster of 100 different notions he'd rejected over the years, which I know he still has. I couldn't tell if he appreciates it or hates it.
He has it somewhere in the attic, at least.
Yeah.
Hey, Cody, good speechwriters are storytellers. I mean, you can deliver a perfectly technical speech, but a good story will stick. Many people, also our listeners, will have anecdotes, things they've experienced, you know. But how do you turn just a general anecdote into a good story? How do you do that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, a good speech writing is good storytelling. They're the same thing. You should never write a speech for somebody that somebody else could give. You know, if you're going to write a speech for somebody, or if you're going to give a speech, it should be something that only you can say, something that is true to you. So you can take an anecdote and build an entire speech out of it. It should speak to something larger than an actual, here's one thing that happened to me once. I mean, what's the lesson you want to pull out of it? And good speeches do that. You know, like, let's go back to Selma. You know, we talked about, it would have been easy to just go there. And for anybody who doesn't know, what happened in Selma was, back in 1965, a group of black marchers and protesters set out to march from the town of Selma, Alabama, for the state capital of Montgomery, just to protest for their right to vote, which they still didn't have. And they were beaten by police before they even got out of town. But ultimately, their efforts led to a Voting Rights Act and a Civil Rights Act, and it changed the course of American history. So 50 years later, for a black president to go back there, that's impressive enough. It's symbolic. You know, the very idea that 50 years later there'd be a black president of the United States stood on its own. And we could have just written a nice speech kind of commemorating that anniversary, but we wanted to make the story of what happened in Selma the story of what happened in America that we, you know, wrote into our founding documents, which were very imperfect. I mean, they condoned slavery, but they our challenge in the opening line is, you know, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. And so we used Selma as a microcosm of America's responsibility, which is to continuously make ourselves better until everybody has the same rights and freedoms and equality. And we're still not done with that. So, you know, the lesson of Selma was we turned it into a broader story, but also into an impetus for today's young generation to keep going and not get cynical and not get disappointed, even if we take a bunch of steps back like we are right now. So all that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, find a story that's true to you, true to what you believe in, and has a broader point to it. And, you know, you can begin with a speech with your story and widen the scope into something bigger, or you can sprinkle stories throughout the speech as long as they stick to one main thesis.
Let's get to the dilemmas.
Oh, yes. Okay.
That will be fun.
Okay.
So, Cody, the rules are very simple. We have some dilemmas for you, and your goal is to choose one or the other as quickly as possible. Okay. And okay. You can elaborate on it afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
There we go. I'm the
quiz master.
I'm the quiz master here. Okay. Cody, morning or evening?
Morning.
Subway or taxi?
Subway.
Too hot or too cold?
Too cold.
Give or take?
Give.
Book or movie?
Book.
Petrol or electric?
Electric.
PowerPoint or flip chart?
Keynote.
Oh. Too loud or too soft?
Too loud.
Speaking or listening?
Listening.
Calling or texting?
Texting.
Spring or autumn?
Autumn.
Paper or digital?
Digital.
Verbal or nonverbal?
Verbal.
Too big or too small?
Too big.
Acquit or impeach?
Impeach.
And Michelle or Barack?
Ooh. Oh, hell no.
We kept that to the last one. You can also have a veto here.
Yeah. Probably good for the working and personal relationships.
Yes, yeah.
Cody, do you remember the first time you met Obama?
I do, yeah. Yeah, very well. So I joined the campaign in early 2007 as a speechwriter, and I never met him once on the campaign, believe it or not. And that's a good thing. It's because he was actually out campaigning in all the different states across the country. And when he did come to headquarters, he'd address, you know, all the staff at once. So the first day I met him was the second day in the White House. It was January 22nd, 2009. And I was working at the time in the executive office building right across the driveway. So I get a phone call from his assistant saying, "Hey, the president wants to see you." And I'm like, I still barely know where the bathroom is. I just got my email set up and everything. And I was like, "Who?" And she goes, "The president, President Obama." I was like, "Oh my God." So I, you know, put my jacket on, I run across the driveway, and you get to the first desk in there is Secret Service. And I say, "Hey, I'm here to see the president." He was like, "Well, you don't have the right color badge." I was like, "I know, I just started. Where do I go? How do I get to the Oval Office?" He goes, "Well, I mean, it's not a Secret Service agent's job to tell you how to find the president." So he says, "Hey, look, you got to go to that phone and call his assistant and have her come down." And I was like, "Okay." So I call and she comes down. She's like, "What's taking so long?" I was like, "Dude, I don't know where anything is." So we go upstairs and I walk into the Oval Office, and, you know, my mouth immediately went dry. Totally dry. Like, it's the greatest home court advantage in the world, and you've only seen it on television. And he's just sitting behind the desk, and he goes, "Hey, brother." And I've never met him before. And like, I can barely talk. So I kind of walk over, shake his hand, and I don't know what he wants. So he's just been looking over the speech that I prepared for him. And he said, "You know, I saw your name at the top and I realized we've never met before. And I just wanted to say hi and meet you." And I was like, "That's it?" And he goes, "Yeah." So we talked about, both of us are from Chicago. He's a Southsider. I'm a Northsider. He's a White Sox fan. I'm a Cubs fan. He taught at the University of Chicago. I teach at Northwestern. So we kind of sparred about Chicago for a little bit. And then he handed me his edits to the speech, and he'd signed it on the top and said, "Welcome to the speechwriting team," which is really cool. And then I walked out and I was like, "What just happened?" But you get used to it over time. It takes a while, but you get used to it over time.
Cody, I can imagine that it must be a hell of a job, especially, you know, during the presidency. You don't get holidays, nights, weekends.
No, no. Nope.
I recall a specific period in the time you were speechwriting when President Obama was still president that was really hectic. You call it, I think, the 5-day period.
10 days.
Ten days. Okay. Could you give the listeners a quick recap of what can happen to a president and his speechwriter in only 10 days.
Sure. And you're right. They're really, you know, you give, part of the deal is you give up weekends and vacations. And, you know, I missed weddings and holidays. And I missed my own birthday party one year. But there was kind of, I heard it was fun. But there was there was this kind of extraordinary span of 10 days in June 2015 where, you know, we weren't expecting any of it. It was a week that was too crazy for the West Wing. But, you know, it started with a mass shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, which, you know, we had way too many of and still have way too many of. But this one had an added racial component because it was in a black church and the shooter was wearing a Confederate flag on his backpack and said he wanted to start a race war. So naturally, we were all pretty upset about that. But also the president has to speak. So I had to write a statement for him to go out and you just kind of reassure the country. Even if there's nothing you can do about it at that moment, it's still a president's job to convince people that the world will keep spinning. And over that weekend, something pretty extraordinary happened. You know, the families of the victims forgave the shooter in open court on television. And I think that kind of calmed the entire country down in a pretty extraordinary way. And, you know, at the same time that week, our Supreme Court was deciding on cases. And, you know, one of them was about Obamacare. Republicans were trying to take down the Affordable Care Act in the courts because they couldn't do it at the ballot box. And that would have denied, you know, millions of people their health insurance. We won that case. The idea of marriage equality was up in front of the court and we won that case too. And suddenly America had marriage equality. And, you know, in South Carolina where that where those shootings were, legislators actually voted. This was the last state capitol to fly the Confederate flag, the flag of the South during the Civil War over it, which was an incredible insult to African-Americans who would walk past it every single day. And lawmakers actually voted to bring that flag down. And then the president went down to Charleston to give a eulogy for the victims and sang Amazing Grace. And when we came back on the helicopter that night, we landed on the South Lawn of the White House and the front of the White House was being lit up in all the colors of the rainbow because it was the same day that marriage equality passed. And just for all those things to happen in the same 10-day span, you know, for America, these were the fruits of, you know, a 150-year civil rights movement and a 100-year movement for universal health care and a 50-year movement for gay rights. For all of those to coalesce in just 10 days in that coincidental way was extraordinary. But I think also, you know, the way President Obama kind of narrated it all for the country over the course of those 10 days and found, you know, the moral center to each of those arguments, I think was a really important thing. You know, you saw, you know, after Charleston, there were no riots, nobody died. But you saw after Charlottesville a couple of years ago, somebody died. And, you know, and President Trump was praising, you know, very fine people on both sides of the argument when one side of the argument were Nazis. And so the president of the United States has to have some kind of moral center to him. And it's the president's job to lay that out to the American people and be, you know, the kind of public conductor of emotions to the best of his or her ability. And I think President Obama did that very well in those 10 days. And it was 10 days where it felt to me like America was finally kind of breaking free of the past into something new and living up to those ideals that we say we cherish. I think we've slipped back since then, but to know that we can get there is an important thing that I think anybody who's cynical should hang on to.
If the listeners to this podcast are entrepreneurs or managers, and I think we all think that President Obama and you as a speechwriter had to deal with like the same problems that entrepreneurs or business leaders do, but then on an XXXL level. So, for instance, dealing with opposition. I think there must have been many speeches, you know, if it were either for Congress or other situations where you could expect to have some opposition to the plan. And I think many entrepreneurs or managers will go to a meeting and they know, I think most of the people in the room will be not in favor of my idea. Could you give them some advice and some ideas on how to still get their point across?
Yeah. You know, It can be very difficult to persuade an opponent, especially now when we're, at least in the States, when we're polarized. You know, there were a lot of things we weren't able to do in the White House because Republicans refused to allow them to happen. And there's nothing you can say to get them to change their calculus. You know, Mitch McConnell is not going to give up his power or change his mind based on anything Barack Obama says. So in that case, rather than try to reason with opponent, we would try to make a case to the American people and get enough of them to care and mobilize and call and vote And the times Republicans bent is when they saw it was in their own best interest to do so. And that's not because of something Barack Obama might say. That's because they're hearing from their constituents and the press is getting on their case. And you finally mobilize, you know, a big enough pressure, you know, a wave of people where they have to break and have to bend. So that's important. You know, it's you're not just going against an opponent. You actually have to build a sustained movement on the outside to help you out. You can't just say, here's what I'm going to do and do it. That's not how democracy works. I mean, sometimes that's how it works in corporate culture, but really making a case to people, building a persuasive case that enough people coalesce around is the best way forward.
So find new allies, increase the pressure, and try that to push the things in your direction.
Absolutely.
Cool. Cody, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I think you will be coming over to the Netherlands to do a session with us. What are you going to do?
I'll be there in March. I'm going to talk about storytelling. I'm going to talk about authenticity. I'm going to talk about a little wow factor, how to impress your audience, how to leave a lasting mark.
Cody, thank you so much for your time and insight during this podcast. And in a minute, we will listen to some key insights from one of your seminars. Now, please join us in listening to some trade secrets from the talk of Cody. Let's learn from the former director of speech writing of President Barack Obama, Cody Keenan.
Yes, politics is messy and complicated and frustrating and disappointing. Trust me on this. I've raised a glass on the Truman balcony when we won health insurance for millions of Americans. And I've cried in the Rose Garden with parents whose kids were murdered in their classroom after Congress caved to the NRA. But we went into the whole enterprise with a boss who told us from the start that our efforts would never be perfect and didn't have to be. That all we could do was our best, to take up the work of others before us, to advance it as far as we could for as many people as we could and then hand it off to a new generation. That's the story of this country. The biggest idea this world has ever had. And keeping that going depends on all of you. I saw something some months ago that got me thinking about this. You know, we've had all these massive marches the past few years, the women's marches, the march for science, the march for our lives. Seas of people showing us what democracy can look and feel like. And one of the things you notice at these marches is everybody keeps trying to outdo one another with clever signs. Where are the scientists? Hands up. You guys have the best science by far. And we are all counting on you to save us. But I've seen this one sign a couple times now that really grates on me. And it said, if Hillary were president, we'd all be at brunch right now. Now I want you to take the name out of that for a second, take the partisan aspect out of that for a second, and think about what that sign said. It said, if the election went my way, I wouldn't be here. It suggested that we only need to care about what happens in this country when our own narrow interests are at stake. And I wanted to ask that person if they'd been enjoying their brunch the last 8 years. Because people who've been fighting for things like better schools, a cleaner planet, equal pay, equal justice, more people with health insurance, fewer assault weapons in classrooms, cheaper student loans, not getting deported from the only country you've ever known, these people aren't spending their Sundays drinking bottomless mimosas. We are not supposed to take off 4 years or 8 years every time our preferred candidate wins. It's like saying, I got into Northwestern. I don't have to do any work for the next 4 years. Of course you do, except for that guy. And I know you did because those goalposts are still in the earth and not in the lake. The work of America isn't limited to people who work in politics. Wherever your next step takes you, med school, law school, the classroom, a lab, the NFL, this country depends on all of us. Reading the news, knowing the issues, voting in every election, being alive to one another's struggles, working to shorten that walk that other people have to make to a stage like this, believing in our ability to make a difference. And I know that can be hard. I know that idealism can be hard. To be an idealist, to open yourself up to the possibilities of what we can do together, that's never an easy thing. It's easier when you're young, when you're still consumed with the idea that you can make things better, when you haven't yet been forced into life's compromises or figured out that the system is designed to exhaust your resolve and your passion. And the cynics, man, they're everywhere. You're gonna run into them everywhere. They'll tell you that idealism is naive, that to expect something better is just blind faith. But there's a faith involved in cynicism too. It's the faith that everybody's crooked, that everybody's in it for themselves, that at best, the system is indifferent to your demands, and at worst, it's incapable of doing anything serious about them. And I know there's evidence for that. I get cynical too when I see ice caps melting faster and bulletproof backpacks passed off as a serious solution and kids ripped from their mom at the border and the people in charge either passing the buck or sticking it back into their pocket. It is safer to be cynical. If you put your armor up, you're never going to get let down. But when you feel that way, I want you to look to our history. I want you to look to the trajectory of this country. I want to look to something that happened in your own life that reminds you of what possibility is. And I want you to grab onto it and never let go.
Thank you so much for listening to Denk Tank, the podcast from Denk Productions. And if you want to learn from the best keynote speakers and trainers from around the world, please don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcast app. Hopefully you enjoyed this show so far, and see you soon at one of our seminars.